Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning, everyone. We're in Upper Westchester, and we're all over, and it's beautiful outside. Of course, it's 100 degrees, but who's counting the numbers outside? The sun is shining, and that's all that really matters. And today, we've got a phenomenal book to talk about. When a case of mistaken identity in Manhattan results in Gia Russo seeing a photo of a Minneapolis woman who looks exactly like her, oh boy, she can't resist reaching out to the mysterious stranger. The Facebook private message exchange blossoms into a budding long-distance friendship, and the two women agree to meet in New York and gauge the truth with their own eyes. Could you imagine walking in the street and finding someone that looks just like you? Well, author, New York Times author Andrea Kane is here, and she's going to tell us more about it, because you too can look in the mirror and see a face to die for. Hi, good morning, Andrea. How are you?
Hi, Fran. How are you? I'm doing just fine, except, as you said, for the 300-degree weather.
Yeah, I'm just so glad to have you here. So the question is, could you tell us about the plot and how you could explain forensic instincts and how you created them?
Okay, well, we'll start with forensic instincts because they're the basis for everything. They actually are the first ensemble I've ever written. It's always been either one protagonist or two, and they kind of took on a life of their own. I feel like they're my best friends at this point. I started out with the idea of Casey, who's the behaviorist, and she organized this team because I found that as I was doing all my other thrillers, I was feeling that, gee, do they have to follow the rules all the time? And here's a group that doesn't have to. They kind of walk the fine line between legal and illegal because their first concern is their clients and solving their cases. So she picked the best of the best in different fields, which I know we'll talk about later about the specific members and everything else. But they take on cases that a lot of times the police just can't handle, sometimes from sheer number and sometimes because it just isn't something that they can do because there's no proof. I mean, there's no evidence, and so people tend, and now forensic instincts become very high profile, so they're well known, and those who seek out private investigative firms would come to them above all else. So that's basically where they come into this. They come into everything. As far as A Face to Die For, it's actually two dovetailing cases that they're working on. One is a woman who's being stalked by basically a psychopath, and the second is the one you just described, where two young women find out that they are identical lookalikes, and they pursue finding out why and how, and in doing so get themselves in a lot of danger because there are people trying to keep them apart, and they seek out forensic instincts help in order to keep alive. So that's basically it in a nutshell.
That is good. And, you know, it's scary because you're walking in the airport and all of a sudden you see somebody tells you that they know somebody, they think you're somebody else. That's scary. That is really like, whoa, life-changing.
Yes.
But sometimes that's fun, too.
So well, the whole idea of doppelganger is really fascinating. So
yeah. Well, if I saw anybody that looked like me, I would just say, no, you're wrong. Sorry. Uh-uh. There's only one me. I think
that's probably what I would say.
But you never know. Yeah, well, a lot of people say, people have walked up to me and say, you look like somebody. I said, no, I'm not that person. So I'm honest, you know, like, don't worry about it.
Well, that's pretty much what Gia does do at the beginning. When she first approached, it's like, that's not me. She's just stunned by the likeness, but it never would occur to her that there was any, you know, connection between the two of them.
Yep. So sometimes you never know when things are going to happen. So we have the forensic instincts, and how many members are on there, and what exactly do they do? They're one of my favorite teams. They're really good because
I love
them.
I say that with humility because honestly, at this point, I feel like they write themselves because they're so real. So I don't really feel when I say, "Gee, aren't they great?" It's not so much that I'm doing the writing; they are who they are. Casey is the president and leader, and she's a behaviorist. She's had a lot of experience with law enforcement and everything else and working with them, so she's got a lot of prior experience before she opened this agency. And Mark Devereaux is a former Navy SEAL, a former behavioral analysis unit FBI special agent, And he comes with all those skills to the team, and he's pretty much Casey's right hand. And then there's Ryan McKay, who is one of a kind. He's a strategist, and he's a techno whiz, and he can pretty much hack into anything that's even things that aren't hackable, he can hack. So that was the original three when they first started. And then after that, actually, Hero came on board. And Hero is a bloodhound and a human scent evidence dog who used to be with the FBI. So his job is to track things with his nose, and he's brilliant. And he's also now Casey's pet on top of that. So he kind of has a double role, a personal one and a professional one, but he's definitely part of the team. And then there's Claire Hedgley, she calls herself a claircognizant, which is what she is, but she's an intuitive. So people refer to her as a psychic, and I guess she certainly does have those abilities because she can tune into things that her gut just tells her are, and that could be a blessing and a curse for her, although it's great for the team. Then there's Patrick Lynch, who was a retired member of the FBI, and he's now not only with them, but he's also their security specialist because they need a lot of security in a lot of different ways. And then most recently, Emma, who I love writing Emma. She's such a hoot. Because she's a young girl who basically grew up on the streets in a lot of ways. And
yeah, I like her too.
And she was a pickpocket. And now she is a reformed pickpocket, but uses those excellent skills to aid and abet. So she's the newest team member. And having come on board, she does lend a dash of fun and humor and also difference. Each of them is different, and I think that's what makes them so special, because they each bring a different component to the whole team.
They are. They're an interesting team because they are so different. I mean, they argue nicely back and forth.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And then when they do a number on Ryan, I crack up laughing. That's all. That's the best.
Well,
and,
Ryan
and when
is,
Emma
I,
comes,
I had, he,
yeah.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
I love her. I love Ryan.
Ryan is, when I created him, I made up my mind that, hands down, he was going to be the antithesis of every computer geek anybody's ever seen. So he's a very hot and handsome guy and is not interested in any of the women who want him because he has no particular affinity for people to throw themselves at him. And then here comes his total opposite, who he has. All they do is argue because, Claire is an intuitive, she's ethereal, she's all about feelings and emotions, and he's all about facts and everything else. So they literally kill each other, I guess pretty much as they say in the bedroom and in the boardroom.
That was interesting, though. So now we've got Gia and her wedding planning event job. And she has this Facebook relationship with Danny, who happens to have the same name as my niece, so she has to be wonderful. And
thank you.
Danny is my future pediatric nurse niece. She's brilliant. So when you wrote Danny, I said, this is good. Tell us about Gia and her winning event planning job and how she meets Danny. Because I have it on the back cover. It says, G and Daniel quickly bond over drinks, childhood pictures, and an uncanny feeling that they share more than just a visual resemblance. So,
okay, well, the
how
first
do they
thing
have...
But what happens is they don't actually meet first. What happens is Gia runs into a friend of Danny's who she thinks is just Danny. She said, hi, Danny, and Gia was kind of like, who? So she sees a picture of her on her friend's phone, and that's her first glimpse of her. And then after that, they strike up a Facebook relationship because her friend goes home and tells her all about her, and they friend each other, and they talk. And eventually, they have such a bond that they decide they have to meet. So in reference to what you just said, Danny flies into New York. She lives in Minneapolis. She's a veterinarian in Minneapolis, and she flies into New York to meet Gia, the wedding planner, as you just said. And they sit down together, and they actually have family photo albums and things like that just to see, they kind of as a hoot, they want to see how much they resemble each other, since everybody keeps thinking that they're twins, everyone who meets them. So that's how it starts. And then they kind of start seeing things that are more than just a resemblance. Facial expressions, specific mm-hmm. things like, you know, a dimple or a space between their teeth or things that are just eerily identical and scary. So that's when they decide to, you know, take it further and find out, because they're just kind of freaked out by the whole thing. I think I would have a heart attack if that happened to me. So they were really freaked out. But that's how their initial relationship got started and how they got on track with the idea of finding out if there was any relationship between them other than just the obvious.
So what happens when they tell their parents, you know, both sets of parents about this?
They don't.
That's
they
hard.
Actually don't tell their
they
parents
don't.
Because they don't want to involve them and get them all worked mm-hmm. up unless there's something to tell. So they pursue it on their own, and they don't go to their parents just to protect them. Oh, I should say, because one of the things that they find out when they're talking over drinks is that each of them finds out that the other is adopted, and each of them are adopted. So because mm-hmm. of that, they... You know, and they have different birthdays, different everything else, and they don't want to tell their parents, look, we have a feeling there's another one of us out there, we, you know, because they don't want to upset them to that degree. And it certainly never occurs to them that their parents were in on anything diabolical, because they haven't even learned anything yet. So it's just a question of them protecting, because they're very close families, all of them. Every character in this book has a particularly close relationship with their family, so...
Mm. This is like, well, the secret's keeping the secrets. This is hard. Must
exactly.
have been hard for them to not tell anybody for so long. And how do you bring up two children and know that there's another one and you don't say anything? That was really that's scary. I would like, oh my God, how could you do that? When you had a whole lifetime that you didn't know. Yeah.
They were very frightened that their parents knew and didn't say anything.
Yeah, I know. Then, well, eventually the truth come out. So when doing this, they realize that they might be sisters, but they don't know. So why did they decide to get a DNA test, and how did they go about doing that? That's the interesting part.
Well, I think what happened was they reached a point, both being intelligent women, that they realized that there was just too much similarity in everything about them. They even talked about the idea that they might have shared, you know, in their past, they might have shared the same biological father. There might have been something that would, you know, they could be cousins, they could be something. It was too, you know, I guess that's the Patty Cathy thing, you know, the identical cousins. Mm. They just they weren't sure, and they decided the only way to be sure, since they're both such definitive people, is to get a DNA test, which they're both very strong-minded, and Gia's a bulldozer, because that's what wedding planners have to be to get things done the way they need to. So they just find a particular DNA center in the city that will, because you need a script from a doctor, you need an appointment, there, you don't just walk in and say, hi, we need a DNA test. So they found a place, which actually does exist, I did a lot of research on that, where you have a doctor on staff, where they can actually go in and get the doctor prescription and get the test there. So, because they went for the works. It was like, test us for any relation we could possibly be. You know, they, obviously you pay for each test. And they just wanted to know anything. So they put in for the full DNA test, and then they had to wait 2 days to get the results.
That must have been the longest waiting period for anybody, for any kind of test. I know that. It's difficult. So, trust is an issue that is at the forefront in this novel, because before all is said and done, Danny and Gia, if I turn the page, try to understand the information and why it was hidden for them and change their lives. So why did you decide to create this element of distrust and hanging over them? Because that's a big deal.
I think it's one of the creepiest things when you write a suspense thriller, when you don't know where to turn and the people that you love the most could be guilty of something, could be hiding something mm-hmm. from you, and you don't really know what's safe anymore. Everything you considered safe and yours isn't. So I think that was, you know, because relationships play such a strong part of all of my novels, I think that mm-hmm. was really frightening for me as the writer to write for them as the characters.
That's true. And I didn't know what to expect some of the times. And I'm saying, like,
exactly.
Oh, my God, this is so, I had no idea what to expect, and I'm saying, I'm not going to figure, I usually figure things out right away, but I said, oh my God, this is too complicated, and this is really good, so guys, you're going to read it, but you're not going to know. I'm so sorry to tell you. You're not going to figure it out, and that's too bad.
I hope not.
So how did, they're not, and there's a lot more that they're not going to know, not from me anyway, and they're going to be surprised, and that's good, because then they're going to want to know what happens next with this group and who's next. So how did Gia learn about forensic instincts and what happens when she connects with the gorgeous Mark?
Well, interestingly, when I wrote The Silence That Speaks, when Mark and Maddie actually were planning their wedding, they hired a wedding planner. And that wedding planner was Gia. And she never was mentioned in any depth, just that they hired a wedding planner. But she was the wedding planner for their wedding, and she knew how, you know, Mark has this aura of authority and take charge and knows what he's doing, and there was no doubt, and she knew he was part of Forensic Instinct, so she went directly there. She just, you know, and bypassed everything, as she always does, and went straight to Mark, you know, and said, help, you know, we're in trouble. There's this danger out there because there's somebody who's trying to keep us from finding out what's going on with each other, which clearly at that point there was. And she just went right in there. And when the team talked to her, and they talked to Danny as well, there was no doubt in their mind that this was a case they were taking.
Mm. So what are some of the special skills that they have, and how do they use them? Did I miss up? Yeah. What are some of the special skills that they would use in order to help them find out what they need to know?
Okay, the special skills, actually in both their cases, because I know that you were talking about the antagonist in the first case, but yes, that was the Professor Hanover in the first case that is on in this book. The special skills are always the same. They are they rely heavily on each of their special talents. They need to enact everything from the behavioral analysis to also they do some breaking and entering that needs to be done. Emma does some posing as a student that is kind of cool. Ryan sets her up as a student at NYU Stern Business School, which is where the young woman who approaches them who's being stalked, Brianna, where she goes, and her professor is the one who's stalking her. So Emma is now a student in the school, and she sets herself up in a way that she's a victim so that they can get evidence. And then there's Hero, who's awesome because he gets to sniff things out and place people where they need to be placed. So he traces the antagonists very often from the scent pads that they make for him. So all of and then there's always Ryan, who's hacking into things and setting up things. And I think that, you know, and Claire actually did some of the helping of the breaking and entering with Casey, because at that time Mark was on his honeymoon, so he wasn't able to help. So I think that each in their own way, with every case that they handle, call upon sometimes one more than the other, but always together, that they use in order to take down people that, you know, this was a situation that the police could not do anything about because there was no proof. I mean, this young woman kept coming to them and filing reports saying, this man is stalking me and he's going to hurt me. Mm-hmm. And there's sexual harassment going on and it's frightening. And they kept saying, we hear you, but you're not giving us anything but your word. And your word isn't good enough for the police, but it's good enough for Forensic Instinct if their instincts tell them that this person is on the up and up. So that's, you know, as a cumulative group, because they do not take on any cases that they don't all agree. They have to have a uniform agreement that this is what we're doing and we're taking on this case. So that in this case, they all looked at each other, nodded, and that was it. They saw that Brianna was telling the truth, that she was in definite danger, and they weren't waiting for something to happen to her before the police actually did something.
That I know. That's unfortunately, because sometimes they just don't believe young people. So Casey Woods is the head of Forensic Instinct. Why is she at the top? And I love Hero. I love Hero, and he's really the star of the show at times. So why was she chosen to be the top person?
Okay, first of all, I think she chose herself because she's the one who started the firm. She used the money that had been left to her by her grandfather, and she followed her dream. She left working for and with other people as a consultant, and she opened the doors of Forensic Instinct and immediately hired Mark and Ryan. So they were a core team that she headed up. She was the unconditional leader and president, CEO, right from the beginning, and she keeps that role. It's kind of a hard road to follow because on the one hand there's camaraderie and they're really a tight team on an equal level, but on the other hand she's definitely the one in charge. I mean, there's no doubt about it. From the beginning of this book, when she kind of walks in the room, she commands the room and she generally commands all the cases, but not in an arrogant, you know, I'm me and you're not kind of thing, but more in a I'm in charge, but I'm going to let you all have your place and your say, and we're all kind of a team together. So that's the situation with Casey. And as far as Hero, actually, he retired he's a baby. He's only like 2 years old, but he still was. I think that in his case, he didn't meet one of the qualifications. I think he was a bad traveler, and that's one of the necessities of being an FBI human set evidence dog. So they retired him. And Casey's boyfriend, Hutch, who's a member of the FBI, brought him to her as a gift. And he soon not only became her gift, but a team member. So he steals the show just because, number one, he's just this gorgeous, adorable bloodhound that everybody loves. And especially Dandy, who, remember, she comes into this as a veterinarian. So she's completely taken with him. But also because he does scent out a lot of the things that, that's his special. Those are his specialties. You know, being able to, Ryan actually calls it the doggy vacuum. There's a specific. Mm-hmm. It looks like a doggy vacuum where they make scent pads out of items that, you know, for example, if they find something in Hanover's office that's personal to him, like a shirt or something like that, then they can use that to make scent pads, and then Hero sniffs, memorizes the scent pads, and he will follow that scent to anywhere to find that person, if that person was where they shouldn't be, or in this case, that's exactly what he did, and he's the one who helped form the evidence that led everybody to the bad guy, so to speak.
Well, we have Emma, and I like her, and she, like you said, she's a pickpocket, and she decided to take down Hanover. Why did they trust her all of a sudden to do that? I mean, what you did was brilliant. It was absolutely hysterical. She's amazing. And the fact that he bought it was even
Emma's
better. The poor thing went to school and she was scared.
Emma was not a student. So this was definitely not her forte, because NYU Stern Business School is one of the top business schools in the country. So she certainly was not feeling comfortable with this role at all, even though she was brought up to speed in every way Ryan could do it, but still in all, you know, even her earbud, you know, nothing was going to be able to prepare her for this. But she, you know, she's grown into this. She started out as the receptionist, and that was exactly what, she was even on probation at the beginning. Casey gave her several months to prove herself, and she more than proved herself in the last novel or two as being a team member. And now she's graduated to being, you know, a full-fledged team member who can do, and she handles certain things so well. And in this case, you know, she's a master manipulator. I mean, it's a wonderful thing, because not only is she able to do that, and able to do that with her skills of slipping things in and out of her pockets and that nobody notices, and out of other people's pockets, but she looks like this, she's like a 22-year-old Alice in Wonderland kind of thing. So she looks like this sweet, innocent young woman, and there's an innate trust then that comes from that, and she uses that to her advantage, because it's kind of like the Artful Dodger, you know, while they're looking the other way, she bats her lashes and ticks their pocket. It works really well.
Well, I can tell you that the plot that you set up for how to get him was amazing, but I can identify that because I had a professor that did that to me.
And did you really?
I you know what, I don't talk about it, but yeah, when I read this, I go, oh my God. Yeah, I graduated college when I was 18, so I was like 17 right before graduation, and this is a new professor, and he was teaching one of my music classes, because I was a music major, and I can't sing, to save your life, and it was sight singing, and I was getting a B at least, or an A minus in the other teacher's class, and he transferred me into him because he's brand new. And unfortunately, I went up to him, I had to pick out what I was going to sing the next time. He wanted me to sing some aria from an opera. That was not going to happen, not really. And he said that if you let me drive you home and you know what I'm talking about, you'll get an A in the class. And I looked at him and I said, no, thank you very much. My brother-in-law is picking me up, my sister's husband. No, he says, you need to tell him not to come or I'm going to fail you.
And wow.
At that, yeah, he did. And at which point I had a weird feeling about this guy. And he had just gotten married, too. And I had two friends outside that actually heard him. And I went to the head of the department, who believed me, because I had witnesses. And I said, I'm transferring, even if you don't want me transferring back into your class, I will not deal with this kind of harassment. And if he dares give me anything less than a B, I'm going to the dean. So I made my
good
point.
Good for you.
Yeah, I was like, and I never ever, I was always this quiet kid that never spoke up. And I go like, no way you're going to ruin my index. No way. Yeah, he thought it was, I don't know who he came on to next, but it definitely didn't win anything with me. I was like, didn't you just get married this week?
Well, I'm glad, first of all, they listened to you, and I'm also glad you had some witnesses, because, nowadays, especially, there's so much sexual harassment and so much false accusation that people just don't believe you anymore.
Yeah, I was glad that my two friends were outside. I said, just listen, because I didn't like being alone with a male teacher, and he wanted to close the door, and I wouldn't let him. And I said, no, this is not going to work. And I stuck with my old guy. It was much better. So
well, that was
G's
very
house,
smart.
Yeah. I learned, you learn. You grow up in the South Bronx, you get streetwise. But I didn't think I was going to be that
case,
smart. But, yeah, you learned.
With Brianna, it was unfortunately that she was caught in the middle of it. But Emma was baiting him, so she was doing this on purpose.
Yeah. So when Gia's house is on fire and she's accused of leaving a candle burning and her photos burned, how does this make it more dangerous for her? Because she wouldn't do that.
She was ripping. She was so pissed off that they would, imply that. But she realized that at that point, she and Danny were quietly looking into things, and they were both frightened, and they did not want to get the police involved, so they kind of played that down because they were afraid that if she had made a whole scene with the firemen, that they would then go to the police and investigate this further, and she was not ready for that. She was freaked out. I mean, Danny had already been mugged, and that's why she had left Manhattan. So it was clear that the two things that were taken, both from Danny and from Gia, were their family photo pictures and their photo albums. Those were the things that were taken, nothing else. The danger was clear with Gia because with Danny, she was she was mugged and her pocketbook was stolen, and it was returned to her with the only thing missing being those photos. But with Gia, her house was broken into, which is a very personal thing. It's your domain. And nothing was touched except a candle that she never brought in there or placed there had supposedly fallen over and burned all her photos. So that was the only damage done. So it was clear. I mean, they were very well aware at that point that there was a connection, that somebody was trying to keep them apart, somebody was trying to keep them from finding out if there was a connection between them that was more than just physical. And that's when Forensic Instincts came into the picture. Because once you know your lives are in danger, then it's no longer just a question of, gee, it would be cool to find out if we're related. And now you're seeing there are people who definitely are trying to prevent us from finding out if we're related.
Okay, I'm going to read the next one off my computer because when I printed these out, it did not print out. What would the next steps be in learning who mugged Danny and who set the fire?
Well, that was their concern. The next steps would be if the cops got involved. What their next steps were is that they went to, Gia told Danny about Forensic Instincts and about Mark, and she made the phone call, and Danny flew right back in so they could meet with them right away. And they had the initial meeting immediately. In fact, Mark went to Casey and said, can we please stay late because I've never seen this bulldozer of a wedding planner this freaked out. I've never seen her lose it, and she's in pieces. So can we please see her tonight? And they stayed late, and they saw the two of them that evening.
Okay, so one second. Let me go back on here. So how did they learn that someone was – this was the cool part. And you often wonder when you're on your phone if, you know, if people hear you or if your phone's being hacked or something like that. And phones can be hacked so easily. How did they learn that someone was hacking into Danny's phone and laptop? And what did they do to help them communicate so that no one could get into it? I always loved hacking. I always wanted to learn how to do it.
Well, that's Ryan, and that's his specialty. And he immediately checked everything out and said, somebody is hacking into your stuff. And the way that they solved the problem is that he gave them safe phones and secure phones and secure laptops and said, on your regular stuff, just have superficial conversations, answer your emails, do what you normally do, but don't talk about anything to do with this, don't relate to any, you know, don't really make any reference to anything to do with what we're investigating. And they knew that. So their secure phones were used for everything and anything that they were doing, and they're same thing with their laptops. And it was interesting because at that point it was just one laptop that was of concern. Later on it became more. We won't go into too much of that, but that's Ryan's job was big because he had to see exactly how far and how extensive whoever was hacking into their phone and laptop, but they were what they were listening for and how far they were going to do that.
So what happens when they finally fess up to their parents? How do they react, and what happens when they finally realize that they have to face this?
Well, that's what happens at that point is that Forensic Instinct steps in and says to them, listen, I know you want to tell your parents, and they absolutely do need to know, but we need to talk to them because we need to see objectively what their involvement is, if any. And this is more than just telling them something that's scary. This is telling them something where they could be implicated, and you can't do that. You're just objective. You're involved. It's your family. And they were very, you know, gentle. They said, it's not that we're implying anything. We just need to find out the bottom line, and you're not going to be able to do that as well as we can. So Gia and Danny deferred to them, and what they did was the Forensic Instinct team split up, and Casey and Claire went to Gia's parents, and Mark and Patrick, who were both back at this point, they went to Minneapolis, and they spoke to Danny's parents. So everybody reacted with utter shock, disbelief, denial, and then utter resignation because they saw that there was proof and there was no way around it. So they were devastated, but they did everything they could to provide whatever information they could to help. So it was a very emotional all over, you know, and then of course, you know, because Gia was local, so her parents wanted to meet Danny. So the whole thing was a very emotional, overwhelming situation for all, not as we expected, considering how close their families were. But it was hard for the FI team also because, you know, they had to be the ones to tell them and to prove it to them, and the parents were devastated.
I know, because they didn't expect anybody to find out. They had no idea.
No, they actually didn't know. I mean, they didn't have any clue that they just knew that they adopted their child, period. They had papers, and they had everything else, but the rest of it they knew nothing about. So it was completely, you know, overwhelming to them to find out that there was a sibling out there of their child that they had no idea existed.
And the fact that they wanted to meet her in the way they did is amazing too, because a lot of people would say, "Now it can't be true. I don't want to know." And, you know, they would just say that there's no way and just deny it, self-denial, but you can't do that in this particular case.
Unfortunately, you can't do it when there's proof staring you in the face, and they were an identical twin is a pretty scary thing to find out about.
Well, that is true. And the fact that they were glad is even better. So tell us how Claire made them feel safe. How does she feel? How does she make them feel safe? And what role does she play? What happens?
Claire has a calming, soothing presence in and unto itself. There's something about her, besides her obvious gift, where she just has a way of calming people down. And she spends a lot of time with them, talking to them, reassuring them. You know, when the phone call came in about, you know, to Gia, Gia and Danny were together. Claire was with them. She purposely was with them when Casey called in and said she had talked to Gia's parents and everything was okay. And she spends a great deal of time telling them that throughout the book about things that, you know, you and I obviously aren't even going into, spending time making it better in ways that they need very much so. So they combine in their minds that wonderful gift of her calming down with the fact that she is so insightful and can tell them things through her own sensations and insights that make them feel calmer as well. And I think that all of that, she uses her claircognizant skills to help solve the cases, but I think she also uses her presence to keep everybody soothed, because a hysterical client is not going to help anything. You need to keep them calm. She's an incredibly compassionate woman. All those things combined, I think, play into how she does her job and how she helps keep them safe and make them feel safe.
I think everybody could use somebody like her.
Yes.
I you know, there are times when everybody, as I know, you get overwhelmed. And out of nowhere, something horrible happens. And you need somebody that can put the perspective and then just, like, calm you down and make you feel like, okay, it's not so terrible. It's going to be all right.
Exactly. It's going to be
so
okay. That's exactly right.
Yeah. So how does Hero save the day? I still love that dog. You've got to keep him. Not let it kill off the dog, by the way.
No, I love animals. So to be a hero is, you know, when a full team member in every way. He is, in essence, the one who brings down the psychopathic professor, because he isolates the fact that he finds where he's been and he directly ties it to some of the ultimately terrifying things that happened to Brianna that she can't prove, but are the most invasive and terrifying personal invasions that happen. And he basically places him there so that the police are, okay, that's it, you're done, and they can prevent a psychopath from hurting other people. You know,
yeah,
it's kind of hard,
like,
because, as I said, it's hard because we're talking about, you know, two dovetailing cases,
yeah,
and at the same time we can't talk about how they're dovetailing, so... That's why you and I are kind of dancing around certain things, but that's what Hero does.
Okay, we're not going to say that anymore. Let me, before I forget, I don't want to forget, tomorrow, people, at 10 a.m. Eastern, the one and only Tess Gerrington, I Know a Secret, and once you find out what that is, I can't tell you. Then, believe it or not, guess who's going to be a guest on A Good Story is a Good Story with Marcia Casper Cook on Tuesday at 4:30. That would be me. And I am being invited to talk about my new book, A Daughter's Promise, which is my promise to my mom that I would never put her in a nursing home. And it's my voice and hers, told in two separate voices, her journey with Alzheimer's from beginning to end. And those people that have read it have said that it really is, it does help people who are dealing with someone that has Alzheimer's, and there's caregiver tips and everything. And I've given out, I think, 100 books so far. And no one turned me down, including my doctors, seriously. On the 4th, at 11 o'clock, I have to remember this, J.A. Jantz is going to be here with Proof of Life. And someone very special on October 10th, Death Overdue with... She's using the name Allison Brooke, which is really Marilyn Levinson, and she's been through a lot. So I'm excited that she's going to be on the show. And on the 12th, Ula. Make yourself an Ula awesome woman. And that's all I'll say about that. And if you want some really good books to read, and Christmas is coming up, and Hanukkah, and Thanksgiving, you could bring presents. So bring A Couple of Million Pieces of A Face to Die For. Bring Proof of Life. I just read T. Jefferson Parker's book, A Room with White Fire. If you want to learn about mental illness and abuse, the book is fantastic. And, of course, Tess, I Know a Secret. And that's just some of what Fran's read in the last couple of weeks. So,
Fran has obviously been very busy.
Fran just started 5 books over the weekend, of course, and left the books at the hotel, and she's going to get them back. And, yeah. We're in the middle of John Land, A Strong to the Bone, which is really good. And I have C.J. Box's new book, Paradise Valley. And I just finished a phenomenal book, and everybody's talking about my review, Polio and Me, by Kenneth Dalton, and it's a true story of what happens when he turns out 5 years old. He has polio, and he's taken away and put into a ward, and he's petrified, and his true story. And he thanked me for my brilliant review yesterday, so that made me feel good. So let's get back to my gorgeous Ryan. I really wish I could meet this guy and he could teach me how to, you know, pack into things, because that would be interesting. Why does Ryan seem to allow Claire to rib him all the time? They have this cool relationship, which is really fun.
I think that that's probably one of the – he has an explanation for everything in his life, but this is the one thing he doesn't. She gets under his skin, and he just – there's this kind of love-hate relationship. Well, I wouldn't go that far. I would say, you know, like hate, like dislike. They just mm-hmm. – because they are incredibly drawn to each other on the one hand, and on the other hand, they are each so different, and it irks him that there's no proof for who she is and what she is. And it irks her that he only wants to talk about the scientific and the proof and not about the feelings and the insights. So they generally get into it. It's either the two of them getting into it or it's Mark and Ryan getting into it. But generally they're poking fun with each other and at each other throughout. So the quips are flying back and forth during the meetings. And every once in a while, even though she's kind of smiling in her coffee cup, Casey has to say, okay, guys, let's move on. It's time to stop. But it's a sparks flying kind of thing, and it makes another interesting facet of the group. It's, you know, their interrelationships are so much fun for me to write and to understand. As I said, they're like dear friends at this point. I know.
Well, I'm
going to
read this tape.
You and I talked about this.
You
want to be say something, which I haven't said yet, but I know you're being so kind and not asking me things that you know are going to give things away, but I do know you wanted me to tell you how and why I created the prologue. That was one of the things you and I talked about. And that one I can answer. You're being so diplomatic and kind, and I appreciate it. But
I crossed out five questions while we were speaking because you left them there, and I'm saying, she doesn't want to talk about that. I'm going to leave it out.
you're really being great. But the prologue prologues in general, I think, could be really impactful in a suspense thriller because they could give you an inkling of either what was or what's yet to be, and you spend the first half of the book trying to figure out where that fits in. You know, what does that mean? How does that impact the rest of the book? And in this case, it was a prologue in the true sense of the word. It happened before the book began by 27 or 28 years. And I created it because of the obvious interest that it's going to generate so people understand that there's a lot of fear, there's a lot of angst between these two natural parents who are killed and whose infants are kidnapped. And I think that because of that, there's obviously, I mean, it's not going to be any great surprise that factors into the book, but it creates that immediate sense of danger and awareness that this is going to play heavily into the book itself.
Well, I'm going to read this from the back cover. You know, it's funny because this back cover really doesn't give away a lot. It gives away just enough, but not a lot. Whereas I was interviewing Iris Johansson a while ago, and I'm reading the front cover, the flap, and I said to her, I'm not going to read this because it gives away the ending. And I knew the ending. I figured it out, like, right away. And I said to her, you need to tell them to change that because she had a fit when I read it to her before the show started. So
that was really great of you, because people don't get it, you know, that if you start to tell things, then why would they read the book? The whole point of a thriller is to surprise people.
Yeah, I know. I don't realize sometimes, because you could actually tell I read the book, and I get into the book, and I know what the book is about. And so I'll ask questions, and then I'll, you know, preface it by saying, if there's anything you don't want to answer, that's fine. But one publicist for next week said, you know, you can't ask all those questions. And I said, that doesn't make sense because I really didn't ask anything awful. So I wound up, you know, taking the first 10 that she said, and I wound up doing what I hate doing, which is, why did you write the book? And how do you create your plots? And I said, like, I don't ask questions like that because nobody cares. But,
And also
I came up with generic
so many
questions.
Times.
Yeah, I mean, generic questions, and I'm saying, people ask the same stuff over and over again, and this publicist thinks that those questions are right. So I think when the author comes on, I'm going to say, you know, I need to at least mention this person. Otherwise, no one's going to understand why the person went after, you know, to find out who killed this person. It made no sense.
Exactly.
Well, despite being embroiled in another case, Forensic Instincts can't turn down the Panic Twins away, and they agree to help. But as the team digs up skeletons long since buried, they unearth the shocking truth about who is willing to destroy the sisters and the families that they have grown to in order to love themselves. So, at this particular point, why can't they turn down a case? They don't turn down anything, basically, unless they think it's not worth their time.
I think that they really turn down cases either that are, you know, something that the police can handle, as you said, not worth their time, or if somebody in some way presented something that was not legitimate, where they knew in their gut that this person was, you know, bringing them garbage and they, you know, weren't interested in helping them. But they're, I guess they're kind of like, you know, do-gooders. They really, in their hearts, want to help people. In fact, they even have a sliding scale payment program where if somebody is wealthy, that's fine. But if somebody, you know, when Brianna comes to them, she's ready to take on a second job to be able to pay them. And they just say, our fee is commensurate with, you know, your circumstances. So if they're moved to take something, their financial situation right now is so good that they are not in a position, they don't have to say, we're doing this only for money. So they tend, when they get somebody who's in a situation like the twins, when they come to them, where they're panicked and frightened and their lives are in danger, they're not about to say, hit the road because you have no proof. It just would never occur to them. And also Mark has the personal connection with Gia of having worked through his wedding with his more difficult mother-in-law trying to run the show. So Gia saved the day and ran the wedding. But all in all, I think that her credibility certainly started the ball rolling, but they would not see people in that kind of distress and turn them away. They have a lot of people who probably seek them out, who they do, because they're so high profile at this point, which they keep trying to avoid, but you can't avoid that when you're as good as they are. Especially Claire, who gets so upset when she's interviewed because she tries to keep her gift kind of quiet. It's not that no one knows, but it's just, you know, then it's immediately like, oh, you have that psychic in there. You know, could she tell my story too? Could she tell me all about my reading? And she's not interested in doing any of that. So she tries to keep a lower profile. But it's kind of hard when you're as good as they are, when they have such a diversely brilliant team, to stay out of the limelight. So they get a lot of people who approach them. And it's up to them to sort of psych out who is real and who is not. And when it's real, they don't turn it down.
I know. You know, it's funny because there are attorneys that deal with these cases, and it's amazing how, you know, no one realized what happened, and obviously whoever dealt with the case dealt with it in their own special way. They didn't, you know, nobody knew, and that's what's even
right.
Scarier. So how did you decide on the different settings for this particular book, the different places where it took place?
Well, first of all, there are reasons why people had to live where they lived. That was the first thing that could, you know, which obviously we can't get into. But also, the whole New York metro area, you know, is so familiar to me because I'm from Westchester County, New York. So that part of the book takes place actually in the city, New Rochelle, which is a city in Westchester County, and that's where Gia's family lives. And so, in general, I grew up, you know, going to Manhattan all the time. I'm familiar with it. And I also just think it's the most exciting city in the world. I still do. So that was a huge – and then, of course, we have offshoots of that. You know, Brooklyn, we have, you know, different parts of New York City that aren't Manhattan itself. But Manhattan is where Forensic Instincts is based. And most of their stories take place in and around the vicinity of. But – you know, as I said, different people live at different places for reasons. I mean, because Dandy comes in, as I said, from Minneapolis. So she's in a different part of the country. And Gia was originally living in Bozeman, Montana, before she came back to live in New Rochelle, where her family, the rest of her family is from. So it's kind of a diverse bunch of places, but most of it's centered in Manhattan.
I know some of those places I actually remembered. And then when you brought up some of the places in Westchester, I go, wait, I know that one. And I love when they bring up things about the Bronx and Arthur Avenue and Belmont and all of that. And I'm saying, like, wait, I used to walk there. And it's great.
Of course.
It makes it more real. So What is next for these forensic instincts, and what role is Emma going to play in the next one, if at all? And when is it coming out?
Okay, the one I'm working, I just started. That's going to take me a long time on this one because my guess is it'll probably come out at the beginning of not this coming year, but the next. It'll be 15 months instead of my usual 12 because it's a rough one. What I did was, for those of you who are familiar with the entire Forensic Instinct series, Aiden Devereaux, who's Mark's brother, and he's a covert kind of an operative unto himself, he has another life that I've alluded to several times in the books, but this next book is his team, and they handle international things as well as national things, and this is a huge case that they work on with Forensic Instincts. So it's kind of like bringing in a whole new team that does things that are really, I mean, I'm doing so much research that my eyeballs are spinning because all the international part of it is all new to me, and it's kind of creepy and exciting all at once. And at the same time, he handpicks the particular members of Forensic Instincts that he needs to help him in this. And Emma is one of the people that he picks for a reason that's very funny, and I'll leave that for when the book comes out. But she's definitely a very prominent figure in there. So it's taking familiar people, but it's adding new people, and it's expanding the roles of everybody and bringing in a whole different element for all of them to play. So I think that everyone will be excited when you meet the new team, but you'll also get the chance, of course, to have the old team as well, because I don't think I could ever say goodbye to Forensic Instincts. I think that first my readers would kill me, and second of all, I might kill myself because I love them so much. So that's next on the horizon, and it's still in its fledgling state as I struggle through the months of research that I'm doing. Also, it's a hectic time for me anyway because, personally, in another 7 weeks, but who's counting, I'm about to become a first-time grandma. So
oh, nice.
I'm very excited about that. So now a lot of the reading I'm doing, is besides being research stuff, is also new children's books to select for my daughter to read to her little girl when she comes. So we're all very excited about that. So I'm sort of playing dual role now. It's like grandma-to-be and writer in writing. So it's an interesting and very hectic time of my life, but I love both parts.
That is so great. You know, when I retired from teaching was because my mom had Alzheimer's. And my sister, before she died, she dared me to review books. And I don't cook, ever. I wouldn't even know what a knob of a stove is. And I reviewed my first cookbook was a cookbook. And for some reason, I made it so hysterical that the author decided to promote it all over the place, and that's how that got started. So, I mean, it's great. I look forward to seeing, like last week, and finally got to see my nieces and my nephews, finally, to torture them because it's fun to torture teenagers and older kids. So it's great. So be a first-time grandmother is really special. That you're gonna. Oh,
it is,
so
and
special.
I feel the way you do. I mean, it makes you feel better. You're not the only one. I would burn pasta every time In fact, I have recently been the only person in the world who's destroyed hard-boiled eggs. They all blew up. I have no idea what I did wrong, but I obviously cannot cook anything. So fortunately, my husband can. Otherwise, we would probably not eat, or else I would get very, very fat on takeout food because I absolutely am a disaster in the kitchen. So that takes care of that. But I am an avid – I mean, I've been reading since my parents started reading to me when I was born, and I was – Everybody used to think that I was reading when I was 2 or 3 years old because I would know when to turn the page from having heard their voices. I would sit with the book, and at a certain point, I would turn the page. And everyone thought, my God, is she reading that? And no, I was just saying the words out loud, and I knew when to turn the page from their inflections and when they read. So I'm really a firm believer that if you start even before birth, but during certainly at birth, reading is something that is yours forever. It's something that you can do by yourself no matter what, even if you don't have a friend with you at the time. You always have a friend in a book. Whether it's an electronic book or a physical book, doesn't matter. The fact is it's a book. And I think that that's unfortunately disappeared so much over these last few years because the young people are turning to different, you know, to their computer games and they live on various different forms of their iPads and their iPhones, which have their place. I mean, I use mine incessantly as well, but not instead of reading. Reading is special, and nothing can ever equal that.
You're right. My mother made me read 10 books a week. That's the secret of why Fran reads.
Good for her.
And I had to take
notes
on the books, and I had to be ready to write a book review or a book report on it. So I never had to worry because I always had 10 books read and the notes. And that's why when I read a book, I destroy it because I take notes and I underline, and nobody could read it after me except for somebody that says, I don't care about your doodads in the book. Yeah, you should see what I do. You should see yours. I mean, I could take a picture of this. And, yeah, I have everything underlined and circled, and this way I remember when I have to write the review, I could just go back to it, or actually I have a photographic memory and I remember it. So it sort of makes it easier. But I really think that kids don't read. My nephews read for school because they're in college, and I try to encourage everybody else to read. And fortunately, my cousin's granddaughter, my niece Penelope, reads. She's my book partner, so on Saturday when I see her, I've got 10 chapter books for how she's going to love me. So,
oh, I think that's
before
wonderful.
We call
it, because
yeah,
you
she likes
if
to read.
Well, if it's not cultivated from early on, then how can it be?
Yeah. Yeah, she's 9 and she's going on 75, yeah. And she said to me, I really like to read these, so I got her every one of them. And then she said, I really like these. I said, they're too easy. So I got her, now that she's in the fourth grade, I got her Treasure Island. And
good,
I got her some
wonderful.
More of the classics. Yeah, and I'm so bad, yeah. And I said to her, when I was taking my reading master's, I said, I read The Phantom Tollbooth, which is probably one of the best books, and The Secret Garden, and of course everybody has to read Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. So I'll start her off on Treasure Island. She read Stuart Little, and she read, she's going to read A Wrinkle in Time. So she reads, and she doesn't have a choice, which is great. So
well,
before we close,
well, my daughter also. My daughter started. I was, you know, in utero. I was reading to my daughter, and now she's going to be a mommy herself. But she's an avid reader and reads everything. She's also a teacher, but she's an avid reader, and I know that our granddaughter will be as well because we won't give her a choice.
This is very true. This is, as a matter of fact, I was very lucky. There's an author. Her name is Carol Roman, who sends me books even though I don't know I'm going to get them. And for anyone who has children that are interested in the history of countries, this is called If You Were Me and Lived in Germany, If You Were Me and Lived in Cuba, If You Were Lived in Malaysia. And the books are written for kids, and they're the best because they learn all about these foreign countries in a fun way.
That's absolutely wonderful. That's wonderful.
And she sends them to me even if I don't want them. So where can we find out more about you and your work?
The best place to go is my website, which is AndreaCain.com. And that will be able to connect you with my social media, my Facebook, my Twitter, all the things that I put up so that you can communicate with me that way. You can email me. I love talking to my readers because that's the way I find out what works, what doesn't work, what they love, what they don't, and it always makes me so happy when I hear I made a difference. So definitely go to my website, check it out, and communicate in any way it makes you happy.
Well, I want to thank you a million times for today. And
I thank
were
you
at
well.
The Thrillers? Were you in the Thriller
Excuse
Fest
me?
This year? Were you at the Thriller Fest
this year? I couldn't
get
there this year. I normally do go, but I couldn't get there this year. Were you
I
there?
Was there. Yeah, you know, my husband gets embarrassed when I do things like walk up to Brad Parks and say, can I get your book to read? And he says, I know who you are. Don't worry, it's in the mail, even before you whatever. Or,
well, that's a wonderful
I
compliment.
Yeah, I never did. I walked up to Carter Wilson, and I said, the fact that you're cute is one thing, but your book, you need to give it to me. Because he was giving some out. I got an autographed copy, and, oh, my God, Mr. Tender's Girl is scary. It's really scary. And Brad Park's book, I'm hoping that his publicist sets up an interview with me in December, Say Nothing. What happens when a judge is on the stand and he's doing something and he gets a text message that says, you better vote this way because we have your granddaughter.
Wow, what a great premise.
Yeah, and Gary Grossman came up to me and he said, you really actually read my book, and I'm disappointed because he forgot to send me the next one, but he sent a special book, gave a special book signed to my husband because he wanted to read his sci-fi book. So it was really, I mean, I do things I never would plan to do, or walking up to people and going, can I have your book? Actually, before we end. I went over to the two guys that I thought were authors. They were the guys that were running the Barnes & Noble thing. So they gave me 3 books because they felt bad. They said, well, we're not authors. I said, but I'll take 3 books anyway for free. And they just gave them to me. And
yeah,
which
really.
Which is really... you know, you never know. I mean, most of the people are really nice, and then there are some that are not that nice and friendly. And I've reviewed their books, and I think only one person, and I won't say who, I went up to her and I said, you know, I've never reviewed your books. I would really be honored. She said, well, you have so many. Why would you need mine? I said, maybe because when I read your book, other people are going to want to read it. And then I walked away. I said, you're lost. I was like,
that was
huh?
really,
and somebody said something
of,
to her afterwards
okay.
and said, that wasn't smart. Anyway, everybody have a great day. And while you're on Amazon, buy a couple of million copies of A Face to Die For. And while you're at it, buy the rest of them too, all of her books. And Christmas and Hanukkah are coming up. And if you're bored, rather than watching the garbage on television and listening to this other stuff that's going on, pick up a book and read. Everybody have a nice day, and thank you, Andrea, so much. Everybody, and bye.
It was my pleasure. Bye-bye.